This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Emil Kang was supposed to be a doctor, so it surprised nearly everyone when he decided to pursue a career in the arts. Emil was the first in his family born in the United States. His parents emigrated from Korea in 1968, and Emil was expected to capitalize in the land of opportunity and study medicine. Instead, he took a job as a receptionist at a New York art gallery. Now, that turned out to be the right choice for him. He made connections with prominent American art institutions like the National Endowment for the Arts, and eventually became the youngest president of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra at the age of 31. It also made him the first Asian American to be president of a major symphony in the United States. And with that reputation in hand, Emil Kang came to UNC Chapel Hill in 2005 to lead a new organization called Carolina Performing Arts. He was told one thing: elevate the arts at Carolina. Today, Emil Kang is executive and artistic director of Carolina Performing Arts and has been appointed by President Obama to a seat on the National Council on the Arts, and he's my guest today on the State of Things. Emil Kang, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Good to see you again.
Take us back. It all starts in New York. Maybe take us back to the story that you weren't there for, your parents making it from Korea. Talk about their story and passage here.
Well, I think it's similar to many, many stories of immigrants. It was actually the Immigration Act of 65 that LBJ passed that allowed a lot of groups to come over to the country for the first time. And my parents, my father was a recent medical school graduate, and it was that degree that allowed him to come to America with a whole slew of his classmates. And we moved to Queens, where I was born, in Jamaica, and my story begins there.
You were introduced to music at an early age?
I was. It was something that I think perhaps is a bit of a cliche among Asian Americans, perhaps. But I was asked to, or told to, play the piano at age 5 and began and moved to the violin a few years later.
How'd you feel about classical music at the time?
I didn't think of it as classical music. I thought of it as listening to my mother.
I see. So what about, did you sense at an early age that your parents had expectations for you and what they were?
Not that early, I think. But what is true is that from the very, very early age, I was expected to not just succeed, but to be better than all the non-minorities, all of the people who we wanted to be better than. Mm. Perhaps that wasn't spoken that articulately, but there was a real desire to succeed in this country. And the reason why they moved here was for my sister and me to have the opportunities perhaps that they didn't have. So the real pressure to succeed was there from the very beginning.
And that success, I guess, as they saw it, was not really, I mean, even though they wanted you to take music lessons, success would not come through the arts. It would be in a profession other than music.
Yeah, I don't even think they imagined that. It wasn't a question of the arts or not the arts. It was a question of success as they envisioned it. And they envisioned what they knew, which included medicine, included law, and funnily enough, included me being a priest. So those were the three occupations that I was offered.
You didn't pursue them, but let's talk about the journey along the way. We're talking a little bit about music, and as you say, it seemed to you like you were listening to your mother rather than producing music. Though you do credit your fourth grade violin teacher with a lot of inspiration that you have for music.
Yeah, I sure do. When we went to her after my mother realized that I should pick my own instrument for the first time, I told her I wanted to play the trumpet in the third grade. And we went to this music teacher, and she told her in her broken English that my son wants to play the trumpet. And this music teacher said, "No, he looks like he should play the violin," which perhaps, you know, can be considered a microaggression, maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But she gave me a violin instead. And, you know, of course, the rest is history. But the good news in all of that is that this was 1976 or 7. The good news is that I'm still in touch with her today. How many years later? So obviously it turned out pretty well.
Yeah, whatever she intended, you stayed pretty good friends. By the way, we have a photo of you in some polyester pants and a violin.
Oh, God, right.
Somewhere around
yes.
there. So go to our website, stateofthings.org, and you'll take a look at our guest playing the violin. But you talked about microaggressions, which you began to feel pretty early on with toward minority populations, even in elementary school, right?
Well, I think like lots of children of at least of, as my mother used to call it, visual minorities, that we were the only ones of our kind. You know, of course, there were Gentiles and Jews and that, but there weren't any blacks, Latinos, or Asians in my school. And so my sister and I were the only ones. You know, we were picked on relentlessly throughout our childhood.
How so?
Well, I mean, as you can imagine, you know, we were hurled racial epithets. I think I like to believe that it wasn't out-and-out racism, and perhaps this is overly optimistic, but that kids like to point out differences in other kids, and maybe this was really a matter of pointing out our differences, and it was just like, you know, another kid having a big nose or having a big butt or whatever, you have you, but for us it was our race that was different. And so growing up, you know, whether it was being bullied, and, you know, these were the days when those things weren't monitored very often, and so we had to survive them.
But you even, and in your case, I guess, even when sort of the commemorations of Pearl Harbor came along, you were...
I remember one incident in seventh grade, one on December 7th. One of the kids, when the science teacher brought it up, one of the kids said, "And look, there's the enemy," pointing out to me, and the rest of the class laughed. I didn't think it was so funny.
Yeah. Well, how were you taking all this? I mean, what were you, you know, were you sort of hoping to go somewhere else, hide, run away?
I think perhaps because of this, but I think also because of a fear of a failure and, you know, a constant need to prove myself, I was very shy and not confrontational and didn't like to stir the pot. Yeah. So a lot of what I did was just to reclude myself and to try to just keep my head down.
You talked about your parents' vision of success for you in comparison to, did you say other non-minorities? Were they comparing you to other minority students? What was the measure of success in their eyes, do you think?
Well, I think that we had two measuring sticks. One was the children of their friends from Korea. So, of course, we grew up going to picnics together on weekends and monthly, meeting up from all over the tri-state area in New York. And of course, their success was measured. I was measured against their success, their kids, from, you know, grade school all the way out to college. But and growing up in a Jewish neighborhood, my parents measured us against a lot of the smartest Jewish kids in the school. So there was a lot of that kind of comparison going on.
And, you know, you have to be fair because they're also enduring a great deal of anxiety. They're coming into a brand new culture. They're having to figure out how to fit in.
Right.
So certainly being achieving some status within your own community among Korean Americans and then the dominant community, that has to be an important issue in the minds of immigrants who have so many other anxieties to cope with.
Well, certainly, because, you know, when they leave their country, there's an expectation that they're leaving for something better. And so there is this pressure that's both explicit and implicit in them from day one to make something better. And so everything they do in their lives is about proving that they were right to leave. And again, that goes back hundreds of years, right? So I don't fault my parents for any of that, but that's the pressure they're under. Of course, my father was the oldest of seven children, and he was the first to leave Korea. And it was very hard for him because he was actually supporting his family at the same time and came to America like many immigrants to then send money home. And, you know, of course, that meant that not only did he have to generate a lot of money, but that his family had to do better than they would have done back home.
You better make the point, right? You
got to
prove your point. You were a solid B student through high school, which wasn't exactly what they had in mind.
I guess I've been outed here on radio, haven't I?
Well, B's are good. B's are good, just not good enough under some circumstances.
Right, yes. Right? To my students who are listening, that's not good enough. Anyway, I was a solid B student, and I was a really good violinist and a really good speller. I guess that's what I was known for, those three things.
Right.
And look, it's actually done okay. I've done okay now.
You've done okay now because you know what you're doing, and that counts for a lot in the real world, in the professional world. But it did mean that you weren't going to get into a top-tier Ivy League school, right?
You know, it reminds me of a story. My parents, with all best of intentions, tried to set bars for me, no matter how unrealistic or inappropriate they were. They believed they were helping me understand what their expectations were. But the one line that I remember to this day that I tell my mother that she would tell me was that, "Can't you at least get into Columbia?" That was a line, I think, for my junior and senior years of high school, she must have said once a month. Because all they knew about were the Ivy Leagues, because right. that's what everyone else knew about. And that's where their friends' children, some of the older ones, were heading to. And so that's what they said to me. And so it was really a matter of sort of top-down expectation rather than bottom-up assistance. So there was no sense of how can we ensure that you are learning how, as best as you can? What are you doing to find your own passions and your own discoveries? It was really about how do you make the mark so that you can achieve these symbols of success.
And the fact is, nobody's talking about their kid if they went to Nassau Community College, right? So the only people they hear from are people whose kids go to Columbia.
Even you mentioning that college gives me the chills, because I can actually just imagine my mother's response to that.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We'll talk about where you did go and where that college education led Emile Kang. Our conversation with the head of Carolina Performing Arts at UNC Chapel Hill continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking this hour with Emile Kang, Executive and Artistic Director of Carolina Performing Arts at UNC Chapel Hill, talking about your upbringing and your above average scores in school that eventually got you at the University of Rochester for economics, right?
Yeah, I think, again, being a fairly proficient violinist and a pre-med student, as I said earlier, my parents thought that would be a really good place for me to go and pursue both. The Eastman School of Music is there, and the university is known for its great medical school. So, but my parents knew that, maybe somehow knew before I did, but that I should major in something that would actually make me a more attractive medical student. So I was told to major in something other than the sciences. And so I was majoring in economics all of a sudden. And with the idea that with an economics major and a violin background and my pre-med requirements, I could make myself to be an attractive medical student.
All right. And that's going along pretty well. But then you changed your mind, right?
Well, it wasn't really going on very well. And I changed my mind. I think it was organic chemistry that got in my way, which is pretty much a cliche, I guess. It was my end of my sophomore year that I realized that medicine was just not for me. And perhaps I knew earlier, but it was the moment that I had the courage to tell my parents. And it was quite the disappointment to them. I remember going home one Christmas break, I think my sophomore year, when I broke the news to them. And my father was very angry in a way that was very hard to take. And I think really now, in retrospect, it was much more so because I had no other plan. Mm. You know, as a young person, we grow up telling everyone what we don't like. And yet I think it's the kids who understand how to express what they do like that find themselves more quickly. Mm. And so, again, I grew up being able to tell my parents what I didn't like, which was a lot. and so I said to them that while I wasn't going to medical school, I didn't know what I was going to do, except that I would continue my economics major, and that was it.
What did you do, though? I mean, again, you had to anticipate this. You knew this wasn't going to be an easy conversation.
No, I, without knowing anything, and if I went back, I would have been more thoughtful in my delivery. But again, I think with most parents, I don't believe that all parents, maybe some, but most parents don't really, they don't believe that you have to do what they think is best for you. Some probably do, but some don't. My parents, I don't believe, did. It was that they felt safe in knowing that if you followed this path, that you would be okay. And so they believed that was the path for me, and that if I did that, then their job was done. And so once I upended that idea, their sense of that security was gone for me. And now all of a sudden, you know, they're flailing in the wind, not knowing what was going to happen to me, without really trying to ask me what I thought about all of that,
right.
Or perhaps give me the tools I think necessary for me to find that out myself.
But you said, I mean, you didn't really have a plan. So if they had asked you, what would you have said at that moment?
I would have said I didn't know.
Yeah.
And I think I might have made some stuff up about business, but that was more on the spot, me doing my best tap dance. But I think the challenge was finding a way to understand how to ask the questions for myself that would help me respond to those things. And again, growing up in a way where you're focused primarily on achieving grades and marks, yeah, and not really about questioning your opinions and examining your sense of self, it really is a very different place and a much more difficult road to pursue.
Eventually, you did settle on art history. How did that happen?
Well, you know, it's it might sound extreme, but as you'll ask my wife, that's what I am, a case of extremes. But there was a girl involved, and she was taking an art history class, and I thought I would do the same, and there was no bigger plan than that. But it was actually the first course that I took that I kind of chose on my own. And my first class was Italian Renaissance art, and then I went up and ended up having enough courses for a minor. But it was my surrealism professor who ended up becoming a really important force in my life. And she was the first professor I remember after that one music teacher that really helped me get to question my own thoughts. And she was very hard on me, just like that music teacher was, but stayed around to listen to what I had to say. And again, like that music teacher, I'm still in touch with her 25 years later. So she must have had an impact on me.
What happened to the girl, or should I ask your wife?
Oh, I don't. As of the second day, that went nowhere.
Was it something that this you suggested that the teacher who was teaching surrealism in this particular class got you to question yourself and get to the core of yourself and what you might like? Was there anything about surrealism that also sort of grabbed you, or was it this
I think there was no simple answer to any questions. And I think that was what it was, because again, growing up in a household where there is a binary paradigm of right and wrong and excellent and poor, when you start to look at art, it's a much broader spectrum of opinion and thought. And even when your opinions are not the sort of the going thought about by experts, your opinions might shed insight into how you're thinking about things. And that's what my professor was able to do, is to say, okay, tell me what you think about this particular painting. And when I was able to say some things, even if they were incorrect, she would actually be able to point out that my insight might lead to other things. And that kind of thinking was new to me in my 20 years of living at that point. And again, I'm saying this all to you now in retrospect. I had no idea that was going on at the time. But I ended up having to do a thesis on the representation of skulls in the paintings of Salvador Dali. Didn't tell my parents about that, that's for sure. But it was really the insight, understanding how I think about those things that gave me some confidence into my own intellect for the first time.
Yeah, and I think that's the hard part for people who, you know, haven't had much experience with art, when they sort of want to know, well, what does it mean? And they kind of quiz the artist on that. And then there's this kind of, well, what did it do for you?
Right.
And it's not an absolute relativism, is it? I mean, it's not just seeing faces in the clouds. There is a kind of couple of points that happened that really triggered a whole body of thoughts that this artwork did. I mean, it's a real kind of conversation between you and the artist.
It really is. And of course, you have to, like in any form of endeavor, you know, there's always a danger of dilettantism here as well, where you're just saying, oh, it looks like there's an eye, there are like, it's a faces in the clouds, or it looks like he's dealing with his own insecurities, or, you know, all of that. But once you have a language or even a forum for pushing yourself, as this professor had for me, you start to ask the deeper questions. But it takes a lot of work, and you need to find a forum where you can actually be tested and be challenged. And, you know, if not college, then where, right? And I think there's a danger, and I think about this now with my students at UNC, that it's so easy to go through the motions of college without actually ever being challenged that way, because you're measuring your own success based on your grades and maybe the clubs you're in, as opposed to who's challenging your opinions.
Right. And how many of your thoughts and opinions have changed as a result of you
over
being
time,
here?
Right.
I mean, that should be a test that kind of measures that change. So talk about this now. So now you're becoming a critical thinker. You're beginning to see the world in a new way and understand there are new ways to see the world. Does this lead you to think you would have a career in the arts, or are you just happy that you're thinking in new ways?
Well, my parents and my friends all thought I was applying for jobs after college at these big banks because I was an econ major.
There you go.
And because I thought my parents would be happy with that. And so I applied for jobs at these banks, and I got an offer at Citibank and Arthur Andersen then, and as entry-level analyst positions, and my parents were very pleased about that. But secretly, without telling anyone, I was applying for jobs at art galleries. The only one who knew was this one professor, who was the one encouraging me to pursue a career because she actually started to see the insight in me and believed that I had something to offer. And again, I think maybe it wasn't about art, but it was about believing that I had something to say about something. And that I had a professional or someone I respected and admired who told me that I had something to say. But whatever the reason, I also did that secretly. And when my parents came up for graduation, I broke the news that I was going to take this job, not at the banks, but as a receptionist at an art gallery. Obviously, it threw them for a bit of a loop.
Ooh, that was the second difficult conversation.
After medical school, yes, it was.
Guessing. Yeah. See, but now you could look back and say that choice, because you could have gotten a job at Arthur Andersen, and you'd been unemployed by now. So you see, the art gallery job was the right choice.
Unemployed and maybe with three houses. Who knows?
Unemployed, three houses, and a short term in prison. Oh, no.
Oh, wait, exactly.
They don't send them to jail. That's you got to be different. Hey, so a receptionist, though. I mean, but that turned out to be a really good job for you because it meant that you were actually running applications back and forth to some highbrow places, right?
For jobs, you mean?
No, but I mean, as a receptionist, you were running into people at the National Endowment for the Arts and that sort of thing.
My first job at the art gallery was, I've been a receptionist twice over, but the first time was at the art gallery, and it was there where I actually just started to test my critical eye and learned how to have a sense of myself. But it was the next step after that when I moved on to an orchestra that as a receptionist for the second time that I started to have a relationship with the National Endowment for the Arts.
Tell us about that.
Well, after a few years, I became manager of the art gallery, and my parents started to become very proud of me because now all of a sudden I was the son who was zagging when everyone else was zigging. And now my mother thought, look at me, I'm such an enlightened mom, and my son is doing something so different while all your boring children are going to medical school. And my son has an apartment in New York, and look at your kids can't even afford to pay for that. Anyway,
yeah.
So forth and so on. But there was another moment when I said to them that maybe the art business wasn't for me, and I had another coming to Jesus moment with myself, and where I thought maybe I needed to have music in my life because I had stopped playing the violin for the first time since age 7. And I ended up getting another job as the receptionist all over again, and taking a huge pay cut to do this and giving up my apartment, breaking the lease, asking my parents to help me, and moving home to my old high school bedroom. Can you imagine? My poor parents.
So and practicing the violin.
Can you just the fact that I would have to go home again.
No, I mean, that's, yeah.
It's the third big disappointment.
Yeah.
And again, I think there was a time when they just didn't tell their friends that I had changed my jobs because at that point, they basically just stopped. They just didn't know what to do. And my mother actually brought her sister in from Korea, who was a noted dean of a school of education, to try to come talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
So for three evenings in our kitchen table, my aunt came and talked to me about how I was throwing my life away. Mm. But again, it was the best decision I could make. I don't think actually I knew any better at that point, but that's what I did.
Well, talk about that, because it was that reception job, I guess, that allowed you to make connections in the larger art world.
In the arts world, yeah. So I started to really get to know composers, performers, conductors, and my job was also to hand deliver our NEA application to Washington, D.C., because back then there were these applications there were a huge box of binders you submitted. And I was sent on Amtrak down to D.C. to drop off the applications. And I remember walking the halls of the National Endowment for the Arts thinking, wow, this is like the holy land. It's like the place where, all of the great things in the arts happen. And this was right on the heels of the big culture wars in the early 90s and the late 80s. And I was watching all of the political debates go on with lots of, our I won't mention their names, but lots of the senators, one of whom comes from North Carolina, and a lot of the controversy there. But I felt very empowered there and wanting to take part and do more in that area.
All right. So then eventually this leads you to the Detroit Symphony.
Yeah. After a number of years, I ended up becoming the first youngest president of a major orchestra and first Asian American at age 31. And I didn't know anything. I didn't know anything. And I had never managed more than six people. Now, all of a sudden, I was managing a $40 million budget organization with over 100 employees and a number of unions and in a city like Detroit.
And what year is this now?
This was 1999, 2000, and 15 years ago now. And it was the most exciting and frightening time of my life.
What led you to apply for that job?
I actually didn't apply for that job. I actually applied for a job as vice president for operations at the Detroit Symphony. And my boss, after hiring me there, that job in and of itself was a huge step for me. I was still among the youngest senior leaders of a major orchestra in America. I didn't know the stats then, but that's where I was. And 4 months after he hired me, he came into my office and said, "Emil, I just want you to know that I'm going to announce that I'm leaving today to go become president of American Ballet Theater. So goodbye." And then I thought, oh, my God, here I am, not knowing anything how to do my job then. But it was a trip with my then board chairman who we went to go visit Itzhak Perlman, violinist in New York, on his private plane, not on my board chairman's private plane. It was my first trip on a private plane, too. And we went to go visit Perlman to go try to convince him to have a larger role with us at the DSO. And being the VP operations, I was in charge of all the artistic matters. And I really handled myself well then. And it was on the flight back that my chairman asked me if I would consider being the interim president when they went through a search. And that's what led to getting the permanent job.
So what did you do? You're 31 years old. You've had some experience with the orchestra. You're operations manager. But as you say, it's a very large budget. It's got you're dealing with a number of unions. It's got a long history. What did you do? How did you train yourself for that job?
I made lots of mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
I made some poor hiring choices. It was, again, another chance to I second-guessed myself constantly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, if I think about it all again, what I would have done differently would have been to really put myself in touch with a number of really important advisors that I trusted and respected. But at the end of the day, you know, nothing replaces experience and years. And at age 31, it was really a real tall task for me to try to figure out.
Well, experience is not a teacher unless you have the humility, as you just exhibited, to acknowledge the mistake, right, and then say, here's what I learned. I mean, that's when experience can teach. Otherwise,
Sure. Experience
is just a long string of nightmares that you're the only one who doesn't acknowledge, but you do. And it was in 2004 that you left the position and essentially were forced out. I mean, tell us that story.
Yeah, it was, we were going through some very difficult financial times. We had raised $125 million. We had opened this huge expansion to Orchestra Hall, which is a historic venue, to build a recital hall, a whole education center and such. But we had raised all this money, but really didn't figure out a way to improve our operating model. And so our own cash flow was really stretched so thin. And we, of course, were on most models where we had borrowed all the money to try to build this building and hoping that donations would pay off over time. And it was one day when the unions told our board that for them to agree to any concessionary agreements that there would have to be a change of leadership.
Mm. So that's 2004. You then, pretty quickly after that, hear from James Meeser, who's the head of the UNC Chapel Hill.
Yeah, actually, you know, I only knew two people in this state, and they were really interesting individuals back then, or still are. One was the president of the North Carolina Symphony, who then was David Waters, and he was a colleague of mine in the field, of course. And the other was Governor Jim Hunt.
how'd you know Jim Hunt?
One of my neighbors in Michigan was very actively involved in promoting Asia in the schools in K-12 education. And, of course, Governor Hunt is very active in promoting those issues. And so he was on a board here in Chapel Hill that Governor Hunt was running. And so he said to me, "Oh, you should meet this, you know, Governor Hunt." And you know, I was big into Asian American issues as well, being of someone who's Asian American.
Yeah.
And when I I got a call from the committee member, David Waters, suggesting that I think about this job. And, of course, the first person I called was Governor Hunt and David Waters. And Governor Hunt was, of course, my reference for this job, which is not too shabby.
This job is the head of Carolina Performing Arts, and we will hear more from the man who has that position, Emil Kang. He, in fact, developed the position. And our conversation continues on the state of things in just a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking this hour with Emil Kang. He's the executive and artistic director of Carolina Performing Arts at UNC Chapel Hill. Also a member of the National Council on the Arts, appointed to that position by President Obama in 2012. So we talked about this job coming open at UNC Chapel Hill. Talk about the recruitment and how you ended up with the job.
Well, the I came down for my final interviews, and I had the pleasure of having a one-hour meeting with Chancellor Mieser. And I found out, of course, that it was his real doing that led to the creation of the position, because he had commissioned a study on the arts at Carolina and wanted something to happen. And we spent an hour talking about Mahler. And for those who know me and know him, know that Mahler is one of our favorite composers. And so for me, it had been a while since I had talked about the joy of music, because I had such a hard time in Detroit. But here I was talking to the chancellor of a university, great university, talking about which was our favorite Mahler symphony and why. And I knew right then that I wanted to work for this guy. Of course, that also came to pass.
Well, he's a musician himself, plays
sure
the organ,
is, yes.
and loves it. So what was his vision? What was he telling you he wanted?
Well, he was a student at University of Michigan and University of Texas, and they both have some real top-notch performing arts presenting programs. And I think it's not an accident that the top research universities in this country also have the top performing arts centers in this country. And it's a very different model than perhaps in Europe or Asia, where they're more state-supported. And in this country, some of the most creative institutions, arts institutions, are at universities. And he wanted one for UNC, and he believed that that was going to be part of his legacy, I believe. And so the renovation of Memorial Hall was going on, and as it was happening, he wanted to take advantage of that renovation by establishing a center that would meet that dream of his.
Well, this gets back to our conversation earlier about the power of the arts to transform thinking and to turn us into critical thinkers, to
right.
allow us to, first of all, trust our own understanding and our own ways of viewing the world, and also turn it a little bit. He sees that as an important component to any university education. You're a finalist, and you utter one of the most preposterous statements in the history of the Academy.
I did. When, as a finalist, I'm actually asked to, we were all asked to, as finalists in senior positions, to give a public talk. And one of the questions I received was a very simple one. "So, Emil, what is your vision for the arts at Carolina?" was the question I was asked. And not having a good answer, I said, "Well, I want the arts to be as big as basketball." And everybody laughed.
Yeah.
The whole room started to cackle, and I guess the long and short of it is that stuck with me. It was the headlines of the paper the next day. This guy, candidate, wants the arts to be as big as basketball. And there was one line, I remember what paper it was, but it said, "Forgive him, for he does not know what he speaks."
even after you got the job, that line followed.
Oh, it followed me around for a few years. No, maybe even 5 or 6 years. But of course, it was the most brilliant thing I could say.
Yeah.
I just wish I could have taken credit for the real thoughtfulness of that. But it was something spur of the moment.
Just plain desperation. Talk about the season, though. As you said, Memorial Hall was undergoing renovation. It was soon to come open. It would open now under your, essentially under your leadership at Carolina Performing Arts. You would now place your performances there. And you got really ambitious really quick.
Yeah, well, you know, I started in January of 2005, and the chancellor and the provost asked me to have a season by the reopening, which was September, but they wanted me to announce it before the summer let out, before the summer began. So that would be in April. So that means I had 4 months to plan. Now, Frank, I'm not sure if you're aware, but our program that we have here now, it takes usually 2 to 3 years to plan a season. And so now we have 4 months. And I'm a staff of one with a budget of $1,000 to buy a computer. And we're
Did you even have an office?
I was given an empty faculty office in dramatic art, for which I was very grateful. but that's all I had. And the I started to make frantic phone calls the first day I got there, trying to say, okay, how do I build a season? And, you know, I don't know if I would have the courage to do this again, but I made commitments to artists and agents without any real ability to do so by saying, okay, Manuel X, just come to play in Chapel Hill and we'll figure out what to pay you and how much to sell the tickets for. And we announced our first season in April without any ticket prices. It was that wow. crazy. And not only that, but I guess people thought maybe that I'd put together a season of 8 or 10 performances. That was never spoken. But I think when I found out afterwards, that's what I found out. But we announced a season of 40 performances. And maybe that's just, you know, my idea of go big or go home. But, you know, we really certainly did that.
But the fact is Memorial Hall had never seen that kind of traffic, right?
No, it hadn't. That's right.
So, I mean, you know, there's going to be that's a lot of parking passes just for one, to name one, to get bands, to get, you know, instruments in and out, people in and out. It was a lot. I mean, there was there any pushback immediately? Like, we can't do this, slow down?
There was a lot of pushback, actually, from some of the administrators and community leaders. And I think it was more not about that first year, but about being able to sustain it over time and how we could catch up to build an infrastructure once we've built this program. And we were doing things a bit backwards. We were actually announcing a season without having a sense of how we were going to execute it. Yeah. And again, you know, maybe that's just a bit of who I am more than anything.
Now that you've got your feet under you, how do you decide? How do you make those decisions about what a season looks like?
Well, it now is a very fluid process that takes years. And we like to do it based on ongoing and new relationships with artists, with managers, with other peers and festivals and performing arts centers around the world. And I think the thing that's most important to me is that I go and see nearly all of the performers we bring before they come. Of course, there are some that I don't need to see, like Buddy Guy, although I just saw him last year, but I didn't. He's coming this year, and I didn't go see him because of, you know, he's legendary. So, but a lot of the more cutting-edge artists, we are going to see all of them around the world and building relationships with them, whether it's with a ballet company, an orchestra conductor, or a new piece.
You know, this is an amazing thing. If you live in a place like the Triangle, North Carolina in general, but certainly in the Triangle, it's become well known for the arts as one of those things that attract businesses.
That's right.
And the economic development is all driven by this thing, as Chancellor Mieser saw. You're not going to have a top-rate university if you don't have a top arts center. And somehow it doesn't act as competition. It generates a market, the fact that there can be all of these great performing arts venues, both at the universities and our civic arenas. It doesn't drive it away. It seems to generate more. What is that form of competition that actually generates more instead of?
I think one of it is also attitude. We, this community, whether it's my university colleagues at NC State or at Duke, or it's our friends at DPEC or the Carolina Theater or the North Carolina Symphony or the Carolina Ballet, we actually understand that all boats do rise and that everyone wants a vibrant arts community, and that we don't compete with each other. We compete with other industries. Mm-hmm. And so we also have to figure out a way to work together. I think part of it's also a matter of survival and wanting to be sure that we're not working at cross purposes.
In 2012, the president nominated you to the National Council on the Arts. Tell us about that nomination process. It's a little more involved than I thought it was.
Well, you know, I guess perhaps there's the cliche of the story of the White House calling you and you thinking it's a prank call. Well, that's exactly what I thought. Wow. I remember I was heading off to a fundraising call, and a call came and saying, "This is so-and-so from the Presidential Personnel Office of the White House." Excuse me? What did you say? And they said to me, "Would you consider a potential nomination to the National Council on the Arts?" I had to think about that for a while because it was a bit cryptic at first. The call was, "We'd like to talk to you about this." And then so I said, "Yes, I'm calling. Maybe they're calling to ask me about their another nomination."
Right.
So anyway, once I say I'd be considered, thus begins this very arduous vetting process that I was told was very similar or exactly the same as it is for ambassadors or cabinet secretaries, which is absurd considering what I was doing. not absurd to consider what they're doing.
Right.
I became best friends with my local FBI special agent here in Raleigh.
They were doing background checks.
They were not only doing background checks, they were knocking on the doors of neighbors, coworkers. They went to my old childhood home in New York. They knocked on doors. They talked to, rifled through my financial records, medical records, talked to doctors, everything.
Wow.
And turned over every stone, whether I wanted them to turn it over or not. But good thing is that I guess I passed the test.
You're clean. Yeah. Either that or you're very good at disguising the past. That you're clean. You're on the council now. What do you do? What does that mean to be on that council?
Well, I think the most important thing that the council does is actually we approve all of the grants that are awarded by the National Endowment for the Arts. We, of course, depend on the peer review process that the endowment uses and, of course, to the specialists in each discipline. But we gather at 4 times a year, we actually look at every one of those applications. But I think perhaps more importantly, we actually discuss trends. Of course, we discuss the annual agency budget and the process that is going through with the legislature in Washington and how we can make sure that both the Senate and the House are fully informed of what we're doing and to make sure that they are supportive of the work of the agency. It is an incredible honor and responsibility to make sure that we are promoting the agency as much as possible so that people are aware of the value that we have across the country. And I think it's very exciting right now. This year is the 50th anniversary of the creation of the agency 50 years ago, and there is going to be a big ceremony later in September. But, of course, the agency has gone through some real hard times, and I think, we are trying to change the narrative. There's still a lot of people having to justify the existence of the agency, and people saying, why does it exist, and it only supports big institutions and so forth and so on. But, of course, that's not the case, and we have for the longest time supported institutions all across the country.
What are the trends? You talked about seeing trends. You see these applications cross your desk. What are the trends these days?
Well, I think it goes without saying that our arts community is more vibrant than ever, and the creativity that they're providing in the work that they're submitting requests for are incredibly creative. I would also say, though, perhaps even more interestingly, that there is a very much a community-oriented approach to arts communities, that creative placemaking is the big buzzword right now. And the agency, of course, is investing heavily in that through Our Town and other initiatives to really help support the development of creative communities, not just creative institutions.
But you see, you get right at it. I mean, I asked you that question about how is it that more generates more and all boats do rise. And in the arts community, where community is central to the creative process, it is indeed a generative industry, unlike the binaries that we find ourselves in, that you found yourself in school, where other kinds of economies and other kinds of political realities depend on division and separation, where a lot of energy is lost, and that's where the competition is dangerous. I mean, it really is a kind of antidote, isn't it, to some of what we feel like are national ails.
I think that's a very good way to put it. I also believe, though, that's a lot harder said than done. I think it's a real difficult for arts institutions who have struggled so long just to make their budgets work, to all of a sudden get them to try to think bigger than that and to think more broadly and to think collaboratively when they've been trying to hold on to that one little crumb. But again, I see that, and that's, a way to understand where they're coming from. And so, of course, we understand that and try to find ways for them to still to lift their eyes up and to see further down the horizon as opposed to just right in front of them. That's the big challenge.
You also teach a class at UNC called Understanding the World Through Music. Tell us about that class.
Well, again, I've been working with Chancellor Mieser since for the last 6 or 7 years. We have been teaching this freshman seminar together where we use the Carolina Performing Arts Series as a laboratory for learning. And it's all freshmen. And it's amazing what a privilege and honor and responsibility it is for us, for you to touch the lives of 18-year-olds who are just walking onto campus. And then we're talking to them about classical Indian dance from the north, or we're talking about partition, or we're talking about Eastern Taiwan, and or how classical Cambodian dance has survived the Khmer Rouge. And for them, we really believe that the arts, in particular through music and dance and theater, that it can really be a window into the world. And the opportunity for our students to start to see how creative practice can maybe light the fire of their own learning.
Yeah, and I think understanding the arts, any of those arts, whether they're sort of homegrown or more exotic in a context, in a political context, it does sort of bring it all alive for you. And you get to feel deeper meanings in the stuff instead of just the exotic sounds of a gamelan or whatever it might be.
And that's really critical. The Orientalist approach to it is something that we are very sensitive of, yeah. of the exoticization of it. So we want to make sure that, first, it's grounded in humanity.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's grounded in tradition and culture, but our students meet the artists, and there is a personal connection always because we want them to see it as a human being expressing an art form that he or she believes in very personally, and so that it goes far beyond a sense of, well, isn't that cool or isn't that exotic, but that, wow, that person has spent their entire lives trying to learn this or master this art form. That's incredibly powerful, and how can I do the same with my own life? And so we hope that there's a lot of a sense of self-discovery that goes on in learning about other people's work.
What kind of advice do you give your students?
For me, it's very simple. Don't believe in false binaries. I'm a really big believer in the importance of navigating nuance, of exploring ambiguity, of developing competencies in how one advocates for ambiguity, how one becomes comfortable with not knowing an answer, as opposed to believing that the answer is the end. For me, the question is the end. And that's hard for students to understand. It was for me, when you're brought up being measured by your grades and by simple yes and no answers and right and wrong, to now being told by someone that I want to know what you think, not what you can regurgitate. It's very difficult. And so we find a lot with our students that we have to really force this issue with them quite often, and that we're not interested in them telling me that the War of 1812 happened in 1812. Mm-hmm. I don't need you to tell me that. A monkey could tell me that. So tell me what about the war was interesting. Right. Tell me about what was happening, what was going on, and what were the circumstances. And tell me more than what's in the book. Mm-hmm. Tell me how it also relates to your experience and your life. Try to make some analogies, make some leaps. And if you can do those things, then maybe you really do understand what was happening at that time.
Emil Kang, Executive Director and Artistic Director of Carolina Performing Arts at UNC Chapel Hill. What a pleasure. So good to talk with you.
Thank you, Frank.
You can find out more about the upcoming season at our website, stateofthings.org, and all of our conversation at that very same website. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.